Last but not least, we'll be speaking with literary critic Nancy K. Miller about a very different approach to tracing American Jewish history. Her memoir, What They Saved, Pieces of a Jewish Past, was just released from University of Nebraska Press. In the book, Miller discovers objects from her father's past that inspire an investigation into what her family chose to forget about itself. Miller is a distinguished professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center, where, full disclosure, I've had the pleasure of working with her as a student. Nancy, welcome to Beyond the Pale.
Thank you, Marissa.
Your book is organized not according to the linear progression of family history, but by the meandering progress of your quest. Can you start by retracing that quest for us briefly?
Yes. Well, very simply put, the book would not have existed if I hadn't received a very strange phone call in the summer of the year 2000. And this mysterious caller, who was a real estate agent in Los Angeles, told me that I had inherited property from my paternal grandparents. That was very puzzling to me because, as far as I knew, they were quite poor and had nothing left. I had no sense that I really had inherited anything. But I did remember that I had seen in my father's papers a file that this looked as though it there was at some point a purchase of property in what was then Palestine. So because this was an inheritance, all the heirs had to be found. And at this point, that would have meant my father's brother and his son or whoever was left of that family. This family, which I'd never known or met. So I had to look for what it turned out to be my cousin, who at the time was 79 and dying. And that was the beginning, because his daughter, who was my age, had already begun doing research on the family, what she called the genealogical thing. So this was the beginning of the book. And there are really, I think, three stories in the book. There's the story of these grandparents who emigrated from Russia in the early 20th century, the story of this mystery uncle who had, I would almost say, immigrated to Arizona. It's not the right word. I mean, he left New York for Arizona in the 30s and had a very sort of interesting career there. And the third story would be the marriage of my parents, which I began to understand for the first time as a marriage between two children of immigrants. But I guess I should really say the fourth story is my story, which is to say the story of my quest to find out, now that the door had opened on this history, to see what else I could find out.
So going back to the land deeds that you inherited at the beginning of the story, it sounds like you got thrust into a complicated history there. The buying of land in Palestine by diaspora Jews before 1948 was one step in a state-building project that could only be completed with the displacement of enough Palestinians to create a Jewish majority state. So how do you reconcile yourself with being an inheritor of that history?
Well, truthfully, that is not how I perceived it in the beginning. In the beginning, I just thought this was a kind of story to dine out on. You won't believe what happened, da-da-da-da-da-da. That was kind of really how I saw it. I didn't see it as having any political implications. I was very caught up in the surprise of it, the mystery of it, what it led me to, and so on. But of course, in the process of doing the research, I began to understand how this happened. And one of the things, though, that I did find out that's which both explains and doesn't explain what my grandparents might have been thinking, was that in 1926, in the 1920s, a person called Yitzhak Feller went around to synagogues on the Lower East Side and was selling these dunams, these tiny pieces of property. Now, the people buying them thought, what my grandparents thought, I really do not know. Did they think they were going to go? Did they think they were building a Jewish state? Did they think it was a good investment in case my grandfather died because the property was in my grandmother's name? I honestly don't know. But I certainly did not inherit any Zionist stories, or I never felt that I came out of this legacy. So when I finally did go, actually, to Israel, toward the end of the book, well, the end of the story, And I actually found this property. It turned out that a friend of mine lived 5 minutes away from where this land was. And I stood on it and saw where it was. I was very, very happy that we had finally sold it, because it would have made me, now that I understand what it was, and now given the current situation, I'm very happy not to be an absentee foreign owner. I'm very happy to be out of it and have it just become another piece of paper in my history.
The most colorful character you discover is your Uncle Sam, your father's brother, whom you had never met. He's the person who you were saying had almost immigrated to Arizona. There was a brief stop in New York first. What was his story?
Well, this was a story I had to completely piece together. He came as an immigrant. He was 9 years old. He was 9 years old, and as far as I can tell from the records, he barely finished. He did not finish high school. He served in World War I and seemed to be kind of a not very successful person. He subsequently, through his sister-in-law, was given a job working for the gangster whose name was Dutch Schultz, who was known as the Beer Baron of New York. And I have to say that it was quite a shock to discover that I had an uncle who was a minor gangster, or at least part of a gangster family. He used to collect money from small businesses and take them up to the Cotton Club, where the money would be counted. So then when he went to Arizona because of the health of his son, he seemed to have enough money to buy a cafe, a small restaurant in South Tucson, and from there began a small political career, but that remained in the history of the city and the Southwest. So he actually was a character, as you say. And I am quite sorry that I never met him.
A number of your revelations were about your parents' different relationships to class. Your father, you say toward the end of the book, was an accidental American who happened to have born in the U.S., but whose own brother was born in Europe. Are there class markers from your childhood that you see in a different light now?
Well, and that's really a tough question, in the sense that if we had been labeled, we would have been labeled as middle-class, professional, Jewish family. But there was a constant struggle around money and whether there would be enough for various things. But what I came to understand now was that the attitudes toward money that were very different between my parents really had to do with their own immigrant families, in the sense that my mother's family was very ambitious and very successful, and my father's family was kind of passive and not very aggressive and didn't seem to care very much about upward mobility. And so I think that the struggle between my parents around money and between the parents and the children around money actually had a much older history that, of course, I didn't make any sense to me at the time.
You've written about your family many times, but not about your father's side. Why did you know so much less about his side, and did it feel different writing about it?
Well, what I came really to see was that my father's family was completely eliminated from the family story. According to the records, I could have known these people. They lived in New York, but I didn't. And the only way I can understand this is that my mother's family was very large and very present and kind of engulfed my father, who willingly or unwillingly became a kind of orphan. And so as a result, when I was working on this history, I really felt on some level that these were paper people. They were scraps of paper. They were not in any way real to me, although here they were, you know, part of this family story of my genealogy. And so it was a combination of it being kind of abstract, but at the same time very compelling because it was so mysterious. And I wanted so much to know who these people were. And the why, I can't really answer. But there was a definite silence. And whoever was responsible for it, or whether it was complicity, I really don't know.
You write, In the euphoric days of 70s feminism, I rejected roots, family, and my father's name as hopelessly patriarchal. Here I am, back, decades later, reclaiming my father's name, but having problems with the tree. The irony you stumble upon is that all the people on his side of the family who have preserved the family history are women. What did you make of that?
Well, it's complicated. It's not an absolute binary. I would say that what it took me a while to realize was that the things that were in the drawer, and I feel like I need to say that the original title of this book was I Found My Family in a Drawer, but for a long time I thought my father had saved things, and then I realized that a lot of what had been saved had in fact been saved by my grandmother, and that he had looked to me as though he had simply taken what she had saved and put it away without ever organizing it or thinking about it. But my grandmother actually saved the day for me, because one of the mysteries and the puzzles I was struggling with was what their relationship to Kishinev was, because that was the only place name that I had for their story. And in the end, I found an album that belonged to my grandmother that had no names, no identifying marks. But when I turned some of these photographs over, I saw that there were messages of farewell from friends in Kishinev. So in the end, her sort of silent, although she never spoke and she never told me any stories, the fact was that in the album, she gave me what I needed to know.
You make two trips to Kishinev at the end of the book, and what did you find there? Did it give you any sense of closure?
Yes and no. I mean, I would say that before I went, in a way, I had all the information I was ever going to get, in the sense that the genealogist had found traces of my grandfather's cousins and so on. So except for the confirmation, which I got between the two trips, of these friends, didn't really get anything concrete. But I learned so much about the city of Kishinev that I realized that this was not a shtetl story. This was not the story that, you know, it's not really the Fiddler on the Roof story as we think about it. In other words, it wasn't people coming from the countryside and living with their cows and chickens and whatever, and then suddenly finding themselves on the Lower East Side. It was really a story of people who had already started to modernize and to be, at that time, European, and to look toward change. And that was the biggest surprise. And also what I learned about the city, that it had a very large population of educated people with many professions. And so in some ways, going to the Lower East Side might have been a step down from life in Kishinev.
One of the most intriguing items you found among your father's things was a lock of hair. Can you tell that story?
Yes. It was one of the first things I found when we literally opened the drawer. I was with my sister, and we opened this dresser drawer, and there was this box that had the label on it of, it was called Savon Violette, which is a French, fancy French soap from the first part of the century, a sort of Art Deco handwriting on it. We opened the box, this cardboard box, and in it are these locks of hair, not a lock, but several locks of hair, sort of thick. And the very first thought I had, or it wasn't really a thought, it was a feeling, it was visceral, was that this was a severed pais. I was convinced that this was hair that either my father or my grandfather, his father, had cut off and someone had preserved as a mark of breaking with the past, because that was kind of the story that I wanted to find. But when I showed it around, people said, oh no, it's not. There's too much hair for it to be pais. Maybe it was a woman who cut off her hair before she was getting married and had to wear a wig. So I went with that for a while. And I was really hoping that I could do DNA analysis to at least resolve the gender issue. But it turns out that without a follicle, without a root, which is, of course, nice irony, I couldn't learn that. And then finally, someone raised a third possibility, which is where I ended up, which was that possibly it was that hair of a child who had had those kind of sausage curls. And because hair is often preserved when a child dies, or someone else dies. In the end, that's what I thought. But it's sort of one of those objects that can lead to many, many interpretations. But the single most important thing, and it's true of almost everything in this book, is that the main thing is that it was saved. It almost matters more that it was saved than who saved it and what it actually was.
In your book, you're able to connect the process of going through a family archive to going through a literary archive in your academic work. How do those experiences compare?
Well, I guess it's kind of embarrassing. I kept trying to cover up the fact that I was an academic because I wanted to reach a wide audience, but I realized that my training really was always with me. For my original specialization was in the 18th century epistolary novel. So when I was studying these letters from between my parents and also between the two brothers, and all the letters, in fact, letters were incredibly important to everything I found, I couldn't help reading them through the lens of everything I had learned about the epistolary tradition, which of course made me somewhat skeptical because I knew how letters had been invented to look real and so on and so forth. But I was also trained not to care about the author and not to care about the author's intention. But of course now, since these were people I cared about, I cared intensely about the circumstances in which they wrote, what they meant. Was it rhetorical? Was it serious? Should I analyze it in a more literary way? So finally, I hope there was a payoff in the fact that I was trained to read these kinds of letters. But I didn't really want to use some of the vocabulary that I had at my disposal to do it. But I do encourage people to go and see if you can find your inherited letters because they're a fantastic source of information.
We just have time for one last question. So to wrap up, you first started investigating this story in 2001, a full decade ago. How has this project changed you over the course of these years?
Well, it's a good question. It's a hard question. I think that the main shift for me was moving from feeling that I had a psychological legacy, you know, my parents, who they were, what they were like, and seeing that I really belong to a certain part of history, and that this history, this family made sense in relation to other people of this generation. So for the first time, the question of first generation, second generation, third generation became very vivid to me, and I saw what it meant. So I guess what I would say finally is that I feel very ordinary, because I see how I fit in this group of people. And I guess I have one other thing that I feel, which is that Jewish history has been dominated recently by the history of the Holocaust and all the new archival material that's come since the fall of the Iron Curtain. But I feel that, in a way, the history of the Holocaust has hidden another history, which has been completely relegated to the domain of kitsch, which is the history of this generation of immigrants from Eastern Europe who came and played a very big role in American culture and in local culture. So that's so I feel kind of like a little solidarity with a group of people whose story has been turned into music, which, however entertaining, does cover up a lot of quite interesting material.
I'm Marissa Brostoff, and you're listening to Beyond the Pale on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and streaming live at WBAI.org. That was Nancy K. Miller talking about her memoir, What They Saved, available now from University of Nebraska Press. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Beyond the Pale on WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org. Many thanks to Sydney Smith for engineering the show today. Stay tuned for Shelton Walden with Walden's Pond.